From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Megan Mack, and I'm flying solo this week because Evan Dawson is on vacation. And while he was off having a good time, Scott Feibusch and I had a fun week talking about books. It was our annual Summer Book Week here on Connections, where every hour of programming was dedicated to talking about books, writing, publishing, the industry, and reading in general. We kicked everything off with what turned out to be the most heated discussion of the week. We were talking about the Master of Fine Arts degree, or MFA. The value of a degree is hotly debated. Supporters say it provides valuable contacts that put writers on a path to success, but critics say that MFA programs encourage students to conform to a specified writing style, and it limits them from exploring their individual aesthetics. In this segment, you'll hear from Melanie Conroy Goldman, an author and associate professor of English at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. You'll also hear from Len Massinio. He's an author and an instructor at Writers in Books. They both have MFA degrees. But first, here's author Louise Wareham Leonard expressing her concern that MFA programs push writers into a life of academia and prevent them from having different life experiences that she says could enrich their work.
What I see a lot now is that people are going from BAs to MFAs to assistant professor to associate professor, and their entire lives are spent in academia. And it is a real problem because I had a list the other day in Poets and Writers. They had all these contemporary writers. I'd say 80 to 90% of them were working within the system. That really worried me because it means what I see from student writing is people who are all having the same experiences in life. And really, I say that quite sincerely. It's a real problem. I've had so many different jobs. I've worked in a seminary. I've worked in an investment bank. I've worked in the outback of Australia. I mean, I've really struggled to make money, struggled and continue to work all these different jobs, but I'm only just starting to get to my material.
Well, I do want to address that, though, because, again, I think there's a mistaken notion that we're being forced into some mold and that we have to thereafter, or that we've been trained, as it were, overtrained, so we have to stay within that literary school idiom. I don't think so.
It's dangerous. It's competitive.
It is.
It's safe because it's a safe salary and it's a conventional job.
Okay, but few people actually who get MFAs get instructorships.
I'm talking about the successful writers in this country. 90% of them being professors. I'm sorry, but that's just not, that's scary to me. Where are the writers who are doing other things in life?
One of the things that people don't appreciate enough is you have to learn what the rules are before you could break the rules. And, I don't think...
We can't wake up at 50 or 60 and decide to become an interesting person and do interesting things when you've spent, 30 years in the ivory tower. You just can't... remake yourself at 60. People try to do that a lot. They come in at 60 and say, I'm going to write this. Some of them can write at 60.
Unless
some of them,
it's too late.
And we've got a gazillion of those books out there. And that's what's boring.
I would be the first person to admit that a lot of people who write academically are... writing tenure papers, they're hacks.
They're not hacks, but it's just there's no diversity of experience.
But you're talking about academic
writing.
I'd like
to weigh in from the academic.
I bet Melanie would like to weigh in, which I understand. No insult to you, but it's...
Oh, no, not at all. But I think that the relationship between academia and writing is much more permeable than the way that you're illustrating it. For example, Hobart and William Smith Colleges, we run a year-long residency for nationally known writers, and we're bringing in Jeff Vandermeer next year. We had Mary Gateskill, Mary Ruffel, some wonderful writers. We support them in academia for a year. They have a very low teaching load, and we hope that...
Oh, great. You can invite me next. I'm ready. I'm coming. Here I come.
They don't call the show Connections for nothing.
We have a lot of writers who visit academia in some sense or other as a way of providing a more stable income, and I think
that's great. Academia facilitates
a life for many writers who are writing
the same life
inside and outside of academia.
The same life.
Well, as you can imagine, our panelists agreed to disagree, but one issue on which they found common ground was on how difficult writing and publishing can be. In our publishers roundtable, we talked about how local shops and writers who self-publish compete at the national level. Chad Post is the publisher at Open Letter Books. He says that while the competition is fierce, there are ways for local writers and smaller publishers to break through.
We have a very fragmented publishing and book culture in the best and worst of ways, in which the big presses, Penguin Random House, who controls like 65% of all books published in the world, can take over and create a book or make a book anytime they want to. The thing that I worked on in Marfa includes bits of stories on City on Fire, the book by Garth Riss Kahlberg, a friend of mine who got paid a $2 million advance. And the second that advance was paid, that book was slotted for review in every single major publication throughout the country and is being made into a TV series. That sort of like automatic publicity will never happen for one of our books, I don't think. But at the same time, we have people like Archipelago that does literature and translation that once James Wood reviewed Carol Ove Knausgaard's My Struggle, that book is now slated for a review in every single major publication. So there are different ways, and there are people who do self-publishing and people who are good at self-marketing, particularly within their genre, and work within their particular fields. And the way that booksellers seem to tie in, for us at least, is that we have a lot of bookseller fans, and then that bookstores act as curatorial repositories for certain types of books and are working on the face-to-face communication, which goes deeper and is more interesting and more viable for a book culture than, say, the Twitter conversation, which tends to be everything ramped up to 20 and trying to get followers and create buzz, but that doesn't necessarily relate to sales or to an actual conversation about literature. Mm-hmm. So I think everything being sort of fragmented allows people to find their way and to find their particular audience. And we do a pretty good job with that, with our type of books and our sort of readers.
We also talked about how poets can find their way to commercial success by interacting with their readers. Our panelists said that most of the poetry sold in the U.S. today is sold at readings and public appearances, where readers can connect with poets in person. One Rochester native who has had a lot of success publishing her work is author Sonia Livingston. She joined us in studio before leaving for County Cork, Ireland, where she's teaching a workshop. Livingston's new book is called Ladies' Night at the Dreamland. It's a collection of lyrical essays about women from history, including Susan B. Anthony and the Fox sisters. Livingston often writes about aspects of her own life, including what she calls gritty stories from her childhood. We talk to her about what it's like to write about her life as herself, rather than fictionalize her experiences or hide behind a pen name.
Writing specifically about, let's say, poverty in Western New York, it's really important to me that I claim that as nonfiction. Not that I want to be out there necessarily. That's actually a little uncomfortable. But when I write about growing, you know, living on the Indian Reservation or Lamont Place, which is in Northeast Rochester, or going to East High and barely graduating, those things are important to our community. And I think if I were to fictionalize, I'm not so sure that they would have much power at all. So for the writing that I do, the fact that it's nonfiction is very important to me. Even in this book, Ladies' Night, while I'm imagining a whole lot, I would never want to imagine so much that somebody could think that these women didn't exist. So the power of nonfiction is in its reality. And for that reason, with memoir specifically and especially, I would have to keep my name on it, or that's how I've done it.
Livingston says the essay form is becoming more popular on the literary scene. Another writer with ties to New York State is Richard Russo. He's the author of a number of books, including Nobody's Fool. Now, if you've read that, and if you've read the sequel, Everybody's Fool, you'll notice that the tone of the second book is much different. It's darker. Russo says, as a society, we've gone through some very difficult times, and those are reflected in his work.
In the 23 years since I wrote Nobody's Fool, I think the world has just become a darker place in so many ways. And the reason that this book is so much darker is that we as a nation have suffered through a lot. We've suffered through 9/11 and the rise of ISIS and a kind of terrifying nationalism that we're seeing not only in the United States but across the world. We're living in much less hopeful times, I think. And the darkness in Everybody's Fool is just, I think, an acknowledgement of everything that's happened in the 23 years since that book was published, and the darker place that not only I as an author, but an awful lot of authors are living in right now.
I was struck especially in reading both books in quick succession at the difference in the way that race is handled between them. And Nobody's Fool, there's one black character who is a cook at the diner, and you see him briefly, and there are a couple of cracks in there about how, you know, he's the only black guy in town, and then he disappears for a while. In Everybody's Fool, it's a much more real presence. You've got the chief's assistant and then her brother, who are both black. Talk to me a little bit about the different ways that race plays in here now.
And Mr. Hines.
Yes.
And Mr. Hines as well, the elderly black man who sits out at the curb in front of his apartment house waving an American flag. Race is much more prevalent in this book. It's a subject in this book. And it's a subject that I've always been interested in. You know, for some writers, I think class is kind of, in America, class can be seen as a subset of race, because poverty in America so often has a black face. But I think it's also possible to see race as a subset of class, just reversing the order and seeing that class, that our various class system in this country, which is much more pronounced than most Americans are willing to admit, is and can be a kind of destiny into itself. And then when you add race as a factor into that, you begin to see race as destiny as well.
Russo also said that exploring those themes was a challenge, but he found it joyful to work through it with his characters. We ended the week by talking about one type of literature that's exploding on the literary scene, young adult books. From graphic novels to coming-of-age stories to fantasy, sci-fi, and realistic fiction, young adults can find books in any genre. But what about the classics? Do they still matter? That's a program all in itself, but on this panel, we talked about how teachers can help make the classics more accessible and engaging for students. You'll hear from three local teens, Hannah Olin, Claire Molinich, and first up, Alexis Toronto.
When we did A Midsummer's Night Dream, we acted out, and it was really fun because, I don't know, maybe it was just me, but I would look forward to the class and picking the character that we wanted to be that day, and it really helped me and the other people in our class like get a feel for it instead of just reading it and staring at the words on the page.
Mm-hmm. I have a friend who's in high school, and she's a big actor. She loves acting a lot, and she always says to me that she hates when teachers make her read Shakespeare because it wasn't meant to be read, it was meant to be seen. So that's when she always loves just doing Shakespeare.
That's great. Hannah, anything before you graduated that stood out in your mind?
Yeah, my teacher made us do two different things. We had to act out one scene from Hamlet, and then we also had to make a sort of trailer for Shakespeare as well. And those were really engaging, and a lot of kids like got into it. And then there were like the kids that, you know, just really, really didn't care. So then, you know, by choice, they didn't get into it. So yeah, I think different ways to get students engaged really helps.
That's it for Weekend Connections, and that's it for this year's Summer Book Week. You can listen to full episodes from the week on wxxinews.org/connections, or you can download them from iTunes. And you can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM. You can also find us on wxxi.org/listen and on the WXXI mobile app. From everyone here at Connections, which today's just me, thank you for listening. Evan Dawson will be back next week. I'm Megan Mack. We'll talk with you Monday.